good to be here. Thank you, Mosaic Rooms. Good to see lots of familiar faces actually in the audience. You have to join in when we get to the sort of conversational part. So this is an opportunity actually for me as well to hear about your work, Bassam, and through this to talk through, I think, our shared interests, issues, questions, possibilities. Obviously, we're completely different generations by quite a long way, and obviously come from different cultures and the different genders, but I think have a lot.
We still can be friends.
I think we can be friends. I think it's okay. So there's a number of things that I, for one, am interested in: the relationship between private, or at least personal, that comes a lot into your work, and public. The art scene in Palestine, in Jerusalem, relative actually to Scotland, to Glasgow, where you're living at the moment. Engagement with people beyond the art sector, because I think we're often in our own kind of little world. As I say, working across cultures and working across disciplines. And in the case of the work that we're doing, well, at least Bissan's doing the work, but linking the past and the present, in this case, through archives. Obviously, politics come into it, obviously, identity politics and representation, but also the joy of making and using different media, which you very much do, and most of all, ideas. So I'm going to grab a few minutes now at the beginning to explain how we know each other and why I'm here, and to raise, to also quickly introduce the work of some other artists who, again, I think cross with some of the interests and the questions. So I co-run this incredibly small programme of work. It's really a research programme called Culture and Conflict, which the intent is to support and promote the work of artists who are addressing international conflict, either because they live in it or perhaps from afar. So as I say, a lot of the work is about research and coming at the issues through art. It's an art programme, it's not a conflict programme, it's not a save the world, make everything peaceful programme. So I just thought I'd quickly, as I say, ground the conversation in some images. So this first one, Martha Rossler, looking from... looking out, in this case, at the Vietnam War. It's called Cleaning the Drapes, or Cleaning the Curtains, as we might say here. Work from a long time ago. But this very distant viewpoint that I think that a lot of people here have about conflict and about issues in other places. The next work is Richard Moss, which opened last week at the Barbican, in the curve at the Barbican. And the subject is very much the refugee shot. A lot of the film is shot with a military surveillance camera that you can literally see detail from 30 kilometres away. It's very much about complicity. It raises a lot of questions. It makes you feel very uncomfortable, not least because you're looking at it, in the middle of London, and you're looking at people who are doing their best to move across the world and having lost most of their possessions and so on. And something that just feels obviously very wrong about that. But it raises questions about art, about how difficult it is, I think, to try and represent some of the things that are going on in the world. There's Ai Weiwei, who created a storm with this image where he posed as a refugee, as Alan Kurdi, washed up on the beach. And again, I think, you'll sort of... It's very difficult material, I think, for artists to go into this current situation that we're in. A lot of it is about surveillance, and this actually is as well a work some time ago by Ai Weiwei that was at the Listen Gallery, looking out. And then there's work by Omar Fass that you might have seen. It was shown amongst a number of places at the Imperial War Museum a couple of years ago. It's called 5,000 Feet is the Best. and it's a 30-minute film work based on interviews with a former drone operator in Las Vegas. So, and it details the operator's experiences guiding these unmanned planes to fire at targets in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and basically to kill people. Then there's the weaponry that sometimes comes into a gallery. In this case, Fiona Banner brought some planes that had seen war and brought them into the Tate Britain. Then there's Wael Shawky, whose work, I'm sure you know, the Cabinet Crusades, but also other work where he places children in the place of real political and military figures, and thereby makes you look in a very different way, I think, at conflict. There's Peter Kennard, again, I'm sure you're familiar with this this work. He's a sort of a kind of stop the war campaigner through his work. He works a lot with young people. He also teaches actually at the Royal College, and another image by him in the next one. And then there's quite a lot of finger pointing, quite rightly. The next image is Coco Fusco. Did a series, the familiar Guantanamo uniform of a prisoner, and a series about the taunts and so on, about the culture clashes, the dominance, and all the terrible things that go on. And then not so late at this parish, Larissa Sansor, born in Jerusalem, lives in London. Who brings some very bitter humour into play in screen-based work, in part, and she works, of course, in other ways as well, addressing Palestinian identity, to get something we come back to. And then Hrer Sarkissian, who actually is here, whose work was shown here not so long ago, actually, basically, this piece is in a sense about destruction, but with the paradox that art is somehow constructive, actually. And so this is poignantly entitled Homesick from 2014, where there was a recreation and then a destroying of an architecturally, an exact architecturally scaled model of the apartment building in Damascus where Hrer parents are still living and where I think you were brought up. And then Francis Alice, who I've just posted on the culture and conflict social media, actually, some notes. He's just been with the Peshmerga on the front line, and he's writing these notes to kind of figure out what on earth he was doing there as an artist and what on earth he could conceivably do, actually. And they're really worth reading, I think. They're like in the form of a diary and the sort of conjecturing about the role of art. And then finally, to come back to Bissan in a way, to make the link with the archive, which will form some part of this conversation, perhaps later on, is the artist Dinkwe Lay, who is, like Bissan at the moment, is, and through quite a lot of your work, has drawn on archives, in this case with respect to the Vietnam War. You might say reconstructing or rebuilding or making a narrative, in this case, out of other people's narratives. So that's the end of that little kind of introduction. And what we're doing at Culture and Conflict really is developing, I think, questions really more than anything else about art in the context of war and the current politics. Research through events like this, I'm so pleased to be here, really, and to, as I say, hear more about your work. We put on events as well as participating in them. We work with artists, and we're really trying to develop a network of interest and also of engagement. So at this point, I turn over to you, Bissan, who's going to talk. We thought it would be obviously most interesting to ground some conversation in your practice, and to go back a number of years and go through some different work that you've done. So over to you, and we're going to get to the side.
Yeah, thank you, Mihaela, and thanks, Nant, for the warm introduction. Thanks for all of you for being here and bearing with the tube production. It is a real honor to be here and talking to you. As Mihaela said, I'm going to kind of take you through a short journey about some of my practices in connection with the concept of archive and how this concept of archive developed over time, and how to reach the point to where our interests intersect. My first point of entry with archives started with this work, which I first produced when I was a student at the International Academy of Art in Ramallah. And this was during a workshop with a London-based artist called Judy Price, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with her. And the lecture, the workshop, was about archives. And in this workshop, we came across this work by Michael Landy, which is called The Breakdown, where he basically destroyed everything he owns. He made a one-week show at Oxford Street, and he destroyed literally everything at his property. Cars, mobiles, cameras, even very precious artworks. And of course, his concept was in response to the notion of commercialism and commodity and commodification of things. And he created an archive of everything he destroyed. So this archive became, at the end, the artwork. And as a young student, I was really very astonished by something that is disappearing in order for an artwork to be constructed. And as a Palestinian moving every day between Jerusalem and Ramallah, where I live and where I used to study, I started to kind of think about things that are disappearing every day in our life, people, neighborhoods, the whole country slowly. And I started to do this research about houses demolition in Jerusalem, because for those who don't know, Jerusalem is by Geneva Convention, by the rules of Geneva Convention, is still an area under occupation, because it's not considered yet, according to agreements, completely part of the State of Israel, although it's controlled by Israel. And it's contested. The issue, when the Oslo Agreement was signed in 1993, the issue of Jerusalem was contested because according to the agreement, the Palestinians should have half of it. But this didn't happen until nowadays. And then this place that is called Jerusalem, with about thousands of Palestinians, are living in a stateless situation. They are neither considered Palestinians nor Israelis. They hold no citizenship, they hold no nationality, and they live as they are residents in the State of Israel, which means my status in UK is similar to my status in my home country, where my father and my grandfather was born. So, and of course, there are lots, part of this, overview that I gave you, there are lots of rules, one of them is the fact that you cannot live in the West Bank, for instance, because once you live in the West Bank, you lose your access to Jerusalem. So you lose your residency. You can no longer access to Jerusalem or elsewhere. Or you can't travel for more than 3 years. You can't just decide to, take a ticket and leave and disappear for 3 years, because they cancel your residency and then you can't go back home. The only way you can go back home is as a tourist with a new passport. And also the issue about expanding. So because demographically Palestinians are expanding, greatly, they naturally need housing and need to build. And once they go to apply officially for these houses, they don't get permissions. So many of them ended up building without permissions. And they wait, in many cases, they wait for you until you build this house, and then they just come and demolish it. And the statistics, roughly from 1967, which is when East Jerusalem was occupied by the State of Israel, until 2015, more than 100,000 houses were demolished only in East Jerusalem. So So I was starting this, I started this conventional research. I was like going to locations, interviewing people, talking to them, gathering information, looking, talking to human rights institutions, until suddenly I was shooting at one location and I found this piece which I, aesthetically I liked so much. It's a piece of bathtub. So I took it home with me, and then from that day I started systematically, in an obsessive way, just going hunting objects. I would just go, like basically how it happens is that they, after they demolish the house, they ask people to clean at their expenses, and then I would just go and take the remnants. Sometimes I talk to the people about it, if they remember where this piece comes from. Lots of information, some of it is recorded. And then I had like a big collection, about like 150, I think, objects. And I started to kind of, you know, play around, think what, how this project is going to end, what I want to do with it. So I decided to kind of like display them in a pretty much forensic way. Here you see, like, this is like our intern show at the Academy in Ramallah, I think 2000. Do I have the date? Yes. 2008, this was, or 9. And this was 2009. And here you see, like, each object is numbered, and then in the number you see there is a caption that describes what is this object, where it came from, the name of the owner of the house, the date of the demolition, a number of people displaced. And some here you see some floor plans, and these floor plans, either they were drawn by some of the owners to show exactly where, like, to show, like, this piece was in this room, so they would just draw the floor plan for the house for me. Or I would just, you know, I would just go to like a architecture office and ask them to provide me with some information. Here, like, what happened is that I kind of like I found already lots of, like, they were, I used an archive by an institution called Al-Baqdisi in Jerusalem, which means that translates literally the Jerusalem Eye. And they have information about, like, they have information about dates and people and numbers. So I was matching the information I was surveying on the ground with the information and already existing archive in order to create my own, to visualize my own archive. So this was in 2011. I got an invitation to show this piece at the Istanbul Biennial. And I decided to take off the floor plans because I thought we displayed 50 objects, and I thought it's going to be really boring to show like 50 floor plans in every vitrine. So I replaced them with the map of Jerusalem. So each object is numbered, and it shows exactly where are the neighborhoods that I was working. So where is the room that every object came from, it's like where is the neighborhood that every object came from, which also helped me also to kind of like focus on the fact that demolition is only happening in Palestinian neighborhoods. It never happens in a settlement, for instance, around Jerusalem. This is an example of how the objects are displayed, like the captions. And usually when I show this, I kind of like leave, this is like a kind of like an approach to leave like a door open or kind of a hint, because here there were like 10 vitrines. I used 9 of them to display the objects, and in the last vitrine I left it empty, and I placed only this document here, which is which lists the 11 neighborhoods where I worked, where I like collected the objects, and there was like a statistic about the number, the current inhabitant in 2011, and the number of people and the houses, the number of houses demolished and people displaced between 2000 and 2010. So, which is also to kind of like leave the door open that it's still ongoing, you know, like there are more objects to come in this vitrine, or like in the future. So this was my first entry ever to the world of archives. And then it started to grow when I started my fourth year at the International Academy of Art, and I was having conversation with my father and another friend, and suddenly I remembered a photo that I saw when I was a child. I think I was like 16, 15 years old, and this photo was this one. And I remember at that time I asked my father, who are these ladies? Because I can't recognize them. And he said, these are the mother and a sister of a comrade that was with me in the prison. And he gave this photo to my father as a souvenir when he left the prison. And at that time I didn't really think about it. But then when I was thinking for like my degree show and what's next after that project and what I wanted to do, I asked my father to give me these photographs, and he gave me like this drawer which is full of photographs and letters, and they are basically mainly exchanged between him and my mom while he was in an Israeli prison between 1980 and 1983. Here are some examples of the letters. So the majority are between him and my mom, which was his girlfriend at that time. And there are some other letters from family members, like this one is, I think, from one of my uncles. This is like a standard Red Cross like a template for a letter. And this is another example. So basically my parents were both from Jerusalem. They never met in Jerusalem. They left to Beirut to study in 1980. They met each other there. They fell in love. They became a boyfriend and a girlfriend. And then while my father was a student, he also got affiliated with a communist fraction called the PFLP. And then as a matter of this, he returned to Palestine for a holiday. And he had testimonies against him. According to the Israeli law, two testimonies are enough to condemn you. So he went to jail for 3 years. And my mom waited for him until he was released. And then they had all this legacy of letters and photographs. And one of the interesting things is that anything at that time, particularly, anything that is exchanged through prison is shared by all the comrades. It's not your own property. So actually, all the comrades in the prison were reading my parents' letters. They were looking at the photographs. They were actually asking my father to ask my mom to send them more photos of them because they wanted to see them together. And coming from a perspective where my classmates were not feeling happy about telling the names of their mothers or sisters because it's a shame, you know, you can't know the name of my sister. And I was like, I felt really dizzy because I was thinking, oh, what changed here? These are only 30 years. Like, why? Where? I want to understand why people at that time or the circle around my parents were able to understand such a love relationship. What made them understand it? I appreciate it. And nowadays in my society, things are getting a little bit complicated. Like here in this example, my mom is actually sending her photo to my father with another man. Is a tour. Is that she's making a tour with him? And I was like thinking, you can't do this nowadays. I mean, at least in my society. So here, like, this is in the back. So she's. This is what translates to some. I love this photo was taken at the Christian Quarter. I'm sending it to you because it's with Mariam. Mariam is her cousin, and her brother was in the prison with my father as well. And this guy is American. So at the early stages, I'm not going to go through these things because just for a matter of time, I'm just like going to focus on. There were lots of. I was just having suddenly this archive, and I would tell you now why I would regard it as an archive, because at the beginning, I was very criticized about, like, why are you calling it an archive? This is like when I tell people, like, family archive, they think I'm coming, like, from a royal family that keeps it, their own archives. And, you know, like, I mean, these were, like, basically thrown in the drawer. Nobody would touch them. And I became aware to this when I started doing my master's in the UK, and I started contextually to research about archives and what archives means. And I would rather call them spontaneous archives because I believe they are very important to be regarded as archives in such a place that doesn't have a mean for documentation. We are very subjected to daily loss. We don't control our own information and our own recording of narrative and history because we are always presented through the superior power that is controlling everything. So I would rather call all these. I'm aware that every house has such collection like this. Everybody has a prisoner, or an ex-prisoner, or a martyr. So, yeah, all these things need to be regarded as archives. So, When I go quickly through this. So what happened is that when I moved here, I was coming from this perspective of comparing between the present and the past, the present that I'm living and the past that is, you know, that I'm observing in my parents' letters. And what happened here is that, like, this present became somewhere else. Like, I'm in London. People don't know what happens in Palestine. They don't know that. They don't understand these comparisons. And even for me, I'm not a passive. Like, I'm not an observer anymore because I don't live there. I live somewhere else. So I started to shift towards these notions of self-historization and self-archivization, in order to understand, kind of like justify, the act of keeping such documents. And from there, I was doing a residency with the Delfina Foundation. And coming from this perspective of self-historization, I was cat-sitting at the house of a friend, and I saw this book at their bookshelf. And my partner gave it to me, and she said, maybe you should look at it. It's, you know, we are from Jerusalem, and you know, might be interesting. It was really interesting because I looked at it and there was nothing about Palestine in this book. Like, it's like this book is 95% ignoring any Palestinian narrative. So I started to do this kind of adding to this book without altering it. Like, for instance, like the Holy Land throughout the whole year, everything is Jewish or Israeli, but there's not, like, there are like the two Muslim feasts, and then the two Christian, like Easter and Christmas. Sorry, and then there is nothing. So I started to add all the events that are managed by or run by Palestinians around Jerusalem, like from beer festival to the lettuce festival to puppet shows, theater, music, all these things. So 10 A5 pages just listing all events happening around Jerusalem. Sometimes I would just, you know, highlight things. Like, for instance, saying if you have ever been to Istanbul or Cairo, you don't need to go to the bazaar in Jerusalem because it's small and not interesting. You can go to the western side. You can find like high street shopping in West Jerusalem. So it's even like directly diverting tourism in Jerusalem. When it comes to the map, we are talking about 2011, there is no mention of the wall, no mention of any checkpoint, and all the settlements and Palestinian neighborhood are merged together and titled inhabited areas, or like publicly inhabited areas. So I kind of like started to distinguish what is a Palestinian neighborhood, what is a new settlement. And in order not to kind of like, you know, I didn't want to like to kind of like to I wanted to share responsibility. So I decided the show, which was curated by Rebecca Heald and Mirna Bamye, happened in two locations. The ICA, the second one, the first one was in Ramallah. So in Ramallah, I decided to exhibit the book and ask people to kind of intervene with it the same way I did it, without altering anything of the book, just add to it. And then the book transformed eventually into this installation, which is a map, the map as it originally came in the book, made out of wood, and it's a chalkboard so people can write on it. Every neighborhood I added was made as a cutout, like either neighborhood or settlement was made as a cutout, so you need to remove pieces of the map in order to reveal what's underneath it. The segregation wall was painted with UV transparent color, so you need to light a torch in order to be able to see where it's located exactly. And there were four locations linking four pages with videos that are connected. Like, for instance, the Rockefeller Museum was built during the British Mandate as the Palestinian Museum for cultural heritage, and this is not mentioned in the book. It just says this is the Rockefeller Museum. It was established in this year, blah, blah, blah. So I went to the museum, and actually there is like the stone still at the door saying Government of Palestine, Department of Antique there. So I just put them next to each other without any further comment. So, and then to come back to the... I'm going to speak for like 3-4 minutes, and then that's it. I'm going just to present three more. I'll try to present them in 1 minute each. Sorry. I've been speaking for like about 18 minutes now. So I came back to to the research of my parents, and I was producing for my degree show in London. So I went for a visit to Palestine. This is where this work was born or conceived, the love speech. I went during the celebrations. I put two lines under celebrations of Nakba, in which is the catastrophe, the anniversary of the occupation of Palestine in 1948. And too many dates in mind. And I was really, the whole scene was surreal. I was in Ramallah, there was like a central celebration, lots of music, lots of political speeches, and people chanting, holding each other on the shoulder, and officials coming and saying, "We will liberate Palestine from the river till the sea," and everybody would, feel happy. And I was like, this was really surreal. I mean, like, it's not like these speakers, it's not even the agenda of their parties to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. And then it's like, it seems like we are all blinded by I don't know, or drugged in a way, as if we are like in a psychedelic party. So I because I was already like in this idea of, you know, like the archives and the strength of the, you know, the words of the letters, I decided to kind of put these two things together. I started to kind of like remove this empty speech from the political speech that we are listening as Palestinians on a daily basis, and replace it with something else. So I collaborated with my father, where I asked him to actually deliver one of the letters that he wrote to my mom as if it was a political speech. I'll just play 1 minute. It's a five minute video. Okay, yeah. This was an installation. So this is a view copy with a translation. Usually it's exhibited without translation and on two opposite monitors like this. So especially in a non-Arabic speaking context, which is, I prefer this display for in a non-Arabic speaking context, because people, once they encounter the first video, they think it's a political speech. It looks like a political speech. But once they turn around, they see the other video, which is this one, where the subtitles appear simultaneously. So they are listening to the sound from the first video, but seeing this empty auditorium. And then they can construct the narrative. So it's basically trying to kind of like deconstruct what is a political speech. And yeah. The second piece I produced is called Radio Beersheva, which is Beersheva is the Hebrew name of Beer Sabah, the Palestinian city where actually my father was imprisoned. And thanks to this archive and thanks to extended conversations, I learned about the radio practices in the prison. Because one of the things that my father was doing is that actually he was acting as a news deliverer. So they were not allowed to listen. Like they had no access to news in the prison at that time. They had central moment where there are like central speakers broadcasting news from Israeli radio station 15 minutes a day, and it was mainly very well projected to kind of like break them down. So they found in many prisons ways to smuggle radios to the prison, and in my father's case the radio was smuggled piece by piece. So it was broken down, radio transit was broken down like this outside, and then piece by piece they smuggled it and they reassembled it, and then they were using it. And they were like working in three different groups. So the people who knows where the radio is hidden, they are different than the people who are delivering the news. So my father never knew where the radio is hidden. He would just, you know, receive it, listen to the news, and deliver it to the rest of the prisoners. So I made this piece where I filmed my hands, documented my hands dismantling this radio. I bought it on eBay from the 80s. Like was produced in the 80s, similar to the ones that they were using. And I incorporated it. So in the background, there is like the sound of it's my sound whispering fragments that are actually excerpts of interviews that I made with three ex-prisoners who used to be in charge of the radios in three different prisons. And of course, there's a sound of tuning, and every few seconds there is like this fragment of sound of whispering up here. So I'll just play, there is a, I have like a, this short video, which is like 40 seconds, just to give you an idea of how this video works. Yeah, so this work is still in the, like, I'm in the process of transforming it into a whole installation where like the sound works separately from the video, and then I'm going to add like sculptural elements also based on the interviews that I made with these prisoners. The last project that I'm not going to speak about, because this, that, like, again, because I said that this is in the process of developing this video, I tried installing it in many different ways. And even recently, last November, I was invited to the Jerusalem Show, part of the Kalandia International, and this was exhibited only as mere sound piece in this venue. And then, of course, I kind of like re-edited the sound. I incorporated more sounds from the prison. You know, it flushes the sound of the guards walking in the corridors, just to put like the audience in this experience of being in a cell. And actually, the venue really worked well in that sense. The last work I'm going to speak about happened when after I finished my master's. I was kind of fed up with my readings and interpretations of this archive. I felt like that my fascination with it is very, it's very personal. It's very personal. It comes also from the way I read things, and it's not necessarily that everybody in Palestine or outside of Palestine should agree with me and should be fascinated by the informations of this archive the same way I see it. So I decided to, I had this residency in Innsbruck for 4 months, and I decided to open up the archive for discussion. So I thank, in collaboration with Büchsenhausen, the foundation that hosted me, I ran workshops with general public where I invited them to come and discuss letters with me. So I translated 4 letters into English, and I was giving them a copy of the original letter, a copy of a translated letter, and one photograph, and then they would I would divide them into groups, and then they would come together and we discuss about it. And actually this was very helpful because my fascination turned into more into a realization, because I started to be aware. I was really fascinated by the rhetorics and the politics that was loaded in those, even if it was love letters, there were lots of politics loaded in there. And I realized that this comes from that moment where there was a communist utopia overwhelmingly traveling around the world. And this utopia has failed. And I became aware of this the failure of this utopia, which didn't fail only in Palestine, but we shared this failure with many places around the world, which really had this the same, like from Japan to Germany to Latin America. So I decided to do a gesture that kind of pay respect to all these people who shared the same utopia with the Palestinian people. So I decided to, I made a selection of 4 letters into 1 letter, divided by topic. So one was describing the prison and how they are sitting, what they are studying, what kind of books they are reading. The second one was the communist definition of love. Of course, all from like how my father was quoting Lenin and Fourier and telling my mom Lenin is saying that the man is the man is the bourgeoisie in the house and the woman is. So it's like, it's also as if he's recruiting her, as he's trying to sell this like communist rhetoric to her through his love. The third one was about the role of women in society. And the last one was salutations, which is how every letter would end. Like, say hello to your mother and your father and Khalid and Zainab and Ali and all these people. And then the text was handed to a translator who translated the text into German language, and then it was handed to a song writer and the composer who transformed the text into lyrics, and then he made a song out of it. And this became like it's an ongoing project. So I would like to kind of the same text translate it into every single language that of the people who shared the same utopia with the Palestinian people, and make a CD of failed utopia at the end in different languages. So when I exhibit this piece, I exhibit the setup of I use the same instruments that were used to compose the song, but the song always goes on belay black, so there is no actual performance, and it's part of the idea that I wanted to kind of like give a hint that this rhetoric exists only in songs. The actual players are not there; they are absent, and they remain absent. So there's only this playback and loop and in the playback. Maybe I'll play 20 seconds of the song just to give an idea. For those who speak German, lucky you, you will understand a little. And it's like, it's mein Liebe, my comrade, my love. So So yeah, and then that was what I've been doing and what I proposed to culture and how I presented myself to culture and conflict. And And then from there, my idea was to approach this archive, because this was like the very first time ever for me working with a conventional archive, with its rules, with its timetable and restrictions, and you know, also oldness and age. So the whole idea was about my approach towards archives, which is visualization, how to visualize an archive, how I tend to kind of try to move this static information, which are kept in boxes and in cold places, into potentialities to discussion and to more comment and even, you know, more mobile and more dynamic and even more able to be seen by a wider audience. So just a couple of examples of the things that I've been looking at. Like this book comes from the Foyle Library, which is based at the Mon Library, which is King's College Library. And it's part of the special collections. This book is from 1924, produced by the British Empire Exhibition, which is where they used to create an exhibition for their colonies, which is something like the Venice Biennial, but for their colonies. Every colony would have a pavilion, and they would exhibit their products, their culture, everything. And here we are talking about 1924, around like 24 years before the establishment of the State of Israel, and this book doesn't contain anything Arabic. The only Arabic thing that this book contains is this ad here, Palestinian Educational Company, which is owned by Edward Said's father. That's the only Arabic thing that this book contains, and the rest is all agencies that the British helped the Zionists to establish in Palestine before the establishment of the State of Israel in 1994. And I have to say that I've already, as someone, went through lots of, you know, alternative education in Palestine, tried to go to community centers where we talk about history and try to understand it in a different way rather than the mainstream way. I already know that the British helped the Zionists to stand, like they facilitated, and this was how the British colonization of Palestine was different from colonization of other places like India or Pakistan, because it was not based on minerals or extracting and or export and import and things like that. It was the whole British mandate was managed by Zionists who really helped facilitating for the future State of Israel. And I was struck by how they were comfortable by the term Palestine. Like the word Palestine, everything in this book is Palestine, 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 Palestine. There's no Palestine here. It's a projection towards Israel. And I was not really sure. I was not really aware of that until I saw it in a material form in front of my eyes. This is like a winery. Now it changed into Carmel, which is the famous Israeli wine company, and they extended to the Golan Heights, which was occupied in 1967. So they grow, it is a Syrian land occupied in 1967, and they grow grapes and they produce wine and they export it all over the world. And I have to say that what is really interesting is it's actually, and this is here it comes, the idea of visualization, like looking at information in the archives, and it's just like trying to understand what's really going on in my head. It's that try to understand how even the Palestinians nowadays, as a governmental body, are using the term Palestine, fighting for a state over 16% of their original Palestine. And the extensive use of Palestine, which is not Palestine, and here we see the extensive use of Palestine, which is not Palestine. And so I started to kind of feel very confused about what is Palestine here? Like, none of these Palestines is actually my Palestine or even the Palestine of my people. So this is also like a, this is like also a point of entry for a future production that we that is still ongoing and under conversation. I'm not going to speak a lot about the archives because on the 2nd of December we have an event dedicated to this project at the Western Room at the Moon Library. So please check Culture and Conflict page if you are interested. So yeah, real estate, own land in the Holy Land, and then you will go straight to heaven. Or yeah, all this. This is also another example, and this is like actually a rather like a dangerous example. It shows like the amount of money utilized in like how, I mean, how they like, you know, utilized every single power, every single penny, every single thing to kind of like, you know, fed into this idea how they make this, the desert bloom in Palestine. And here, like, it shows how they are actually recruiting and convincing Jewish people to immigrate from all over Europe to Palestine. And in terms of visualization, I actually feel like I would add another page here of Palestinian refugees actually being kicked out of Palestine as a result of this. So yeah, lots of cutouts, lots of letters, newspapers. Yeah, just, you know, some examples of the materials that I've been looking at in the past couple of months. Thank you so much for your listening.
Just to quickly explain the how this. Call it a project at this point, came about was that we were aware, me and my partner, that there were these rather amazing archives, a number of archives held in London, obviously the Imperial War Museum, where I think quite a lot of artists go, but also these very nationalistically put together archives, military archives at King's. And we thought maybe this was material that artists hadn't necessarily looked at. We just thought it'd be interesting to have artists with different heritages and a British kind of heritage to go and look at this material and not necessarily to make a work as a result of it, but maybe to make a work as we'll see what happens. Yeah. But really to just perhaps raise some questions or pick out some material or just to play with this material. So we went to talk to the archivists who we'd never met before and said, would you, you know, we'll raise the money, but would you be interested in would you support an artist to come here and look at this material? And they went, yeah, that would be amazing. We've only had one artist here and they couldn't really remember very much. And said, do you think they'd be interested in the Balkans or the Afghan wars from 100 years ago? Or what do you think they'd like? And we've got maps and photographs and they've got all this material. And we just thought, God, that's amazing to have people to you know, who would be properly interested. And obviously the material that you come up with it's kind of can be a little bit volatile, shall we say. But they were, I think they were completely up for that. Yeah. And so we went through a process and were delighted that you agreed to, you know, to begin to look through this material. And then after the first day you'd been there, I remember one of the archivists saying that you'd taken this one pamphlet and sat and looked at it all day. Yeah. And they thought that was sort of really fascinating. And then you were saying the other day that if you talk to them, the next morning there'll be a pile of documents on your desk.
They were extremely helpful. Like sometimes because they're like the Foy Library has 200,000 objects. Like when you go to the catalogue online, you don't know where to start. If you type Jerusalem, you will have everything from photographs to books to names that I never came across. So I would just tell them, listen, this is my area of research. I'm interested in 1, 2, 3. And then the next morning, I'll just go and see like 5 boxes on top of each other. And they would spend like 15 minutes giving me an induction of the contents of every box. Yeah. So they were really, I mean, if you, this is like a good, useful information. If anybody really interested, they are really amazing people to work with.
And I remember that first meeting we had with them, and one of them said, "What do you think you might do?" And you kind of laughed and said, "Well, maybe this will be a song." And I thought, "Oh God, that's going to go down really badly." And they were like, "Ah, oh, so interesting." That's kind of like, yeah, you need people like that, and they know the material so well. That's the kind of pleasure of it too, really, and they kind of love it, and they. So that was great. I mean, it seems to me from your talking through your different interests and so on, so much of it is about making visible in some sort of way. And I was kind of curious about your search for Palestine, which was shown in Ramallah, as you said, and here in London at the ICA. Would that have been possible, interesting, difficult to have shown that in Jerusalem, say, or, I don't know, Tel Aviv or somewhere? Would that be
It's not impossible. Actually, I once received an invitation to show it in Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, to be specific, and I had to turn it down because... It's just because I really follow like the BDS parameters, and I don't really work with any Israeli money because I don't see it as like a kind of like the positivity of why the intention of working with me, why someone would want to give me money as an artist to do an artwork in West Jerusalem, and in the next morning they would demolish other 20 houses of Palestinians. Mm. So it's just I just something that I don't want to be complicit in. So this was never shown in an Israeli context, and I don't think it, as long as Palestine is still occupied by Israel, I don't think it will be shown in an Israeli context.
But I think it's a very interesting sort of expectations, really, and so culture, or call it art, it's often, there's a lot of people I think are very interested, like Daniel Barenboim and so on, to use culture as a way of bringing people together and so on. And I know that when I went to Jenin in the West Bank and met up with a young kind of filmmaker, and I went with one of my two sons who's in his early 20s, and he said, "Oh, mate, you should be working with Israelis. You should be doing a kind of project to bring everyone together." And I'm just saying, actually, we're not politicians, and it's actually, that's kind of not helpful in a way. I think
bringing people together has to happen in equal pace, in equal paces. I mean, we are always talking about building bridges. You can't build a bridge between someone very low and someone very high. You would be setting up ladders where someone is just looking from the top onto their, occupied subject, I think. So the moment... Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Darren Barenboim, these kind of Israeli figures who are kind of respected in the Palestinian context, simply because they are recognizing all the rights of the Palestinian people. They are not asking the Palestinian people to compromise their right of existence, to compromise their right of being equally treated in a democratic place with freedom of mobility, freedom of living, freedom of earning, freedom of studying, and... freedom of governing themselves. So these kind of Israelis who are not asking the Palestinians to compromise on these fundamental rights, we have, I don't think any Palestinian have any problem with them, because the thing is not about, the issue is not about ethnicity or religion. It's about the occupation. It's about this political body that is there, and it's a rejection towards this political body.
So how can you talk a little bit about your route to using this vehicle, should we call it, this art, this material, this way of dealing with things, the past and the present, maybe the future even. What was your path to that? Can you talk a little bit about the you have a brother who sounds like he's chosen a very different way of working with maybe some of the same interests.
I think this, like the fact that I became an artist is a matter of a coincidence that I found while I was in search of myself. Basically, I was always feeling that I need to kind of express my feelings and my thoughts about everything that is going around me as a human being, and I was trying different things. I was involved in theater. I tried to learn an instrument. I was writing poetry when I was 18, 19. I studied IT for 4 years, and then I threw it in the rubbish. And then I found art. I started to be interested in making something, you know, like trying to kind of like transcribe your thoughts into materials. And thanks to the International Academy of Art, which totally changed my life, because that place really showed me that I can actually combine my way of thinking as a human being with making a creative product without being like, you know, nurtured as an artist since I was a child. Because in the educational system of Palestine, I've never holded a brush or a pencil to draw something. So this is how you know becoming an artist came into being for me, and I think I'm not taking this profession as something separated from what I'm thinking on a daily basis. It's everything is interconnected. You can see all my beliefs, my family, my thoughts. They are all there in my practice.
And that education, as we call it, then it seemed like there are quite a lot of people coming from all sorts of different countries into that institution.
It's an international academy. It was established in 2006. They started receiving students in 2007. It was founded by a group of artists, independent artists from Palestine, who wanted to kind of give the new generation an opportunity to learn something new, but also do something sustainable. So this idea came into action after an agreement with the Oslo National Academy, which funded the establishment of this academy and the graduation of four groups, four or three, I'm not sure. And I was part of the second group. So we were following the Norwegian standard for teaching art, which was based on workshops. So there is no fixed curriculum. We used to have between 6 to 12 workshops every semester, where artists from all over the world would come and present their works. Lecture, make tutorials, run symposiums. There was a very good exchange program that you could join starting from the second year. So yeah, I mean, this is a fantastic place. It's really a place that really made me the artist I am today.
And do artists sort of, because of the situation, do you feel they get dragged, including, you know, you've done it of your own volition, but dragged into the politics, or are there all sorts of people who don't necessarily resist that because there's this difficult thing that we've talked about here quite often about, you know, if you're Palestinian, you're expected to kind of...
I mean, my observation, since I got to introduce to art and I started to understand what is art, and which was in 2008, because for 2008, for me, art was painting and photography and sculpture. Based on my personal observation as a Pisan, I would say that there are kind of three kinds of art, like three kinds of practices. This kind of artists who are trying to be political because they are from Palestine. So even if they throw a rose, they would try to kind of, like, you know, we say, dress it with the Palestinian kaffir.
Right.
In order to say, yeah, this is not, but you can see the color, the brush, it's all about Palestine, it's all about politics. There are other artists who fear this because they say, no, even if you see the political in the work, they say, no, it's not political. I don't want to be political. I have nothing to do, not because I'm Palestinian, I don't want to be seen or perceived as political. I don't like these two kinds of artists. Mm-hmm. I like artists who are honest. If you want to make, if you want to deal with politics, it's fine with me as long as it is really honest, sincere, based on awareness and on a sustainable, like in a concrete research. And if you manage to convince me with your production, I buy it. Yeah. And that's how I try to, that's how I kind of aim to deal with my practice. I don't fear to be seen political because I'm from Palestine, and I'm not trying to be to avoid politics. I'm just honest with whatever interests me. I just go with it.
Well, I think one thing is positioning yourself, and then the other thing is being positioned by all sorts of other people, and kind of resisted the Palestinian artists.
But how can you resist it? I mean, you will always be the Palestinian artist, yeah, the Egyptian artist, the Syrian artist, the British artist, the Scottish artist. I mean, it's with, like, with, you know, this global art market and global art scene. I don't think we have, like, we can try to resist it, but I don't think it. Maybe I just don't want to bother myself, you know, with thinking a lot about it.
Maybe rather, you know, about 207 questions, but maybe we kind of open it up a bit to you if anyone's got any particular observations or comments or indeed questions. Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to speak, you know, about our question for Bissam. You know, I think archive, you know, in the case of Palestine, because it's not a state, you know, each state has an archive to tell a story of the citizenship. Like here in Britain, you can go to the archive and know who's your grandparents for the 19th century. I think in the case of Palestine, you know, archive was where the Palestinian narrative is suppressed and oppressed. And actually, Bissam did the, you did hear archive the war, but you know, if you go to the Israeli National Library in Jerusalem, you will find loads of Palestinian artifacts that has been archived through a systematic looting in 1948.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think my question to Bissam is, you know, in the case of Palestine, it's like archive is where Palestine is buried. You know, how you bring it alive, or how you see it, how you see your peers, or, you know, new generation, try to deal with this, you know, bringing the dead, you know, Palestinian in the archive, to the present.
Yeah.
And another question, do you see the archive as just a past, or it's something still living, especially with your parents, which, you know, it's an archive, but they are still living in the present.
Yeah.
So how do you see
It's a very difficult question, especially the first part is a very difficult question, because I can't speak on behalf of every Palestinian artist about what they are doing in order to kind of, save the dead. I don't think art, you know, I don't want to put more responsibility on art more than it should have already. Because after all, we are artists. We are trying to kind of, like, you know, magnify things, highlight some things, but we cannot sort out problems. We can try to, through our creative way, we are trying to be, like, active and participate in the whole cause of Palestine. But there are some very interesting examples, like what Emily Jasser was doing with the work about the book, like the book archive in Jerusalem. There was in 1967, when the Israelis occupied East Jerusalem, actually in 1948, that Talbiyah was occupied in 48, because it was part of West Jerusalem. Then this neighborhood, which is called Talbiyah, it was like a kind of like an elitist neighborhood where intellectuals and kind of wealthy Palestinians moved outside of the old city and established this neighborhood where they built these, like, pretty villas, and they owned big numbers of books and art objects as well, and they all ended up in the Israeli archive. some of these intellectuals, the family of Edward Said, for instance. Emily went to this archive and she took what she tried to document with her mobile, mobile camera. She documented lots of these books and she exhibited them in a very overwhelming way, where you enter a room and you see just all these like fragments of history all around you. There is also a big tendency towards opening the old notebooks of families. One of the biggest examples is Inas's work here, who's my friend and who's an artist that I really admire from Palestine, where she went through through the history of her family to kind of reveal one story and how the narration of one story can differ. So there are interesting examples, but the question is how we can actually archive these archives and put them into one body that can actually construct a strong narrative that can be that can be used as a manifestation for a suppressed history. But the second question was about
the past, but
archive is never about the past. I mean, I really follow what Dreda said, that it's always a projection towards the future. With everything, even when you look at the video of my father, maybe you can laugh, but it is a kind of manifestation to say that this shouldn't remain like this. This is absurd, and it's a reflection of the absurdity of reality. But then, what comes next? So there's always an invitation to the future. There's always that the same with the last box that I left open. It's what comes next? Shall we do something to stop houses' demolition, or I will keep collecting objects and make more vitrines out of it? So it's never about the past.
It's funny, actually, because I was trying to write something about the archive, actually, and then in doing that, you kind of research what other people have written, and you think, shit, they've said it much better than I'm ever going to. And so I kind of cut and pasted this thing from the ICA, actually, which was about the archive, which was, there's an increasing presence of archive material and exhibitions in recent years, and the notion of the archive as a point of departure, which I think is really nice. And the person who's written this thing on the ICA site has put a point of departure as opposed to a point of termination for artists and curators, academics and activists. And then it goes on to talk about Kate Eichhorn, who's written The Archival Turn, actually in feminism. But she says, the archive functions, and I quote, not only as a conceptual space in which to rethink time, history and progress against the grain of dominant ideologies, but also as an apparatus through which to continue making and legitimising forms of knowledge and cultural production that neoliberal restructuring otherwise renders untenable. Everyone talks about Derrida when you're talking about the archives. It's quite nice to be able to quote somebody else, actually. And any other questions?
I was just going to ask about moving between that personal and bigger, but you talked about the idea of the solution, alternative narrative, and then I guess with your current work, you're going through an archive where you're not looking at stuff that's as personal as your family. How does that work in terms of you then guided by your personal response, where your interest takes you? Do you think you're then providing it out to people again as a way of having as well?
I don't think it goes against my interest or it changes my interest, because At the end, my interest is to kind of visualize this and come out of something of it. But I think the difference is that I have less burden of ethics, when it comes to, I'm not like, even if it's my own family, I have to kind of respect their position in my work, and that really put me through discussing everything with them, saying, I'm doing this song, do you like it? This is how it translates, this word changed. So this is the only different thing, I think. I think this kind of archives, when it's which is more historic and less personal, it has a bit of room, like a bit of democratic room, where you feel like I have my right as part of this history, I have my right to access to this archive and do something with it without the burden of who owned it and what to do with it.
But I know there's also that kind of great freedom you have as an artist to be able to skip through pages and books and back in time and forward and, kind of play with things. Because I was a bit worried about you just thinking, oh, my God, there's all this material. It's like there's too much. And kind of how on earth do you penetrate that in some sort of way? And where do you stop and what do you use to,
I think, through looking at materials, it triggers things and ideas in my head, and then I start to narrow down the focus. Like at the beginning, I was saying, okay, the British Mandate in Palestine, 1917 until 1948. And then I started to kind of focus on, narrow it down to this question of the use of the term Palestine. So all the, to kind of research all these institutions that were called after Palestine, where they were located, even some addresses in the UK, which is nowadays they turned into Burger King or something like that. It was fun to go through all this, the more your head gets around the information, the more you can kind of narrow down what the focus. Mm. But it is, after all, it is really a lifetime project. I mean, it depends on if I want to split my interest into 10 focuses, and then I can do 10 different projects, and each one of them can take up to a year, to look in details and produce and fundraise and et cetera. So
that's always that difficult thing, when you're filling in funding applications, and it's you have to say how long something's going to take and what the scale of it is and what the purpose is and all these kind of impossible questions, actually. And then sort of allow things to deviate and wander and, whatever. I mean, we commissioned an artist to spend some time in Kabul, and, it's taken years, actually, for some of that work to, some of his ideas and responses and so on to kind of translate into something which looks like an artwork, shall we say.
Peter has a question.
That was really interesting when you said about the failed utopia that the PFLP was working towards. I'm curious if you are going to do anything else with that, because it occurred to me that the British Empire, the Pax Britannica, was a kind of former attempt at utopia. And the Zionist project is also very utopian, of course, and they say every utopia has a dystopia in it. And I'm curious if you're going to take that and do it.
To be honest, I haven't thought of further development of this context. But sometimes what happens with me is that during a research, it triggers something else, and then I move to another project, which is kind of inspired by the original idea of the research, which is what happened with your search for Palestine reduced no reserve, which is the book. It's not connected with the archives of my family, but because I was in that research and researching that archive, I came to produce that idea. Mm-hmm. So what happened here with this failed utopia? I started to kind of think about the Palestinian utopia, which is this idea of a state, democratic state, the institutions, the currency, the independence, and it's all premature looking state that has no borders and no power, no control whatsoever. So I started to produce actually potential currencies for uh, for this state, but I was not as a sort of like in a futuristic manner. Rather, it was to kind of because what happened in this situation of like this utopian Palestine is that we the bank replaced ideology, the you know, which like, you know, communism or whatever you want to call it. And we are all following this bank, but the bank is but the Arab bank is my ideology. It's I have to pay my debt. I have to work every day of my life to give money to this bank for, you know, the loans of in my university, my car, my iPhone 7, everything. So I started to kind of play around that and produce these currencies where I'm actually creating fictional banks that has the names of ideologies. So like the communist bank, and then I play around the character that is placed on this currency as well as the architecture. Like I have already one ready one. Just to make things easier. Yeah, this one. So this is like the national bank. We have like this is Yasser Arafat on the front, and then on the back there is this is the house of the Palestinian Berlusconi, called Munib al-Masri. He's like he worth like $3 billion, and he owns like 70% of every institute, like everything in Palestine, from telecom to mobile to Coca-Cola, everything. And next, in front of it, the Declaration of Independence. And I picked this part which speaks about, like, you know, the future shape of the state of Palestine. So it's a kind of like trying to have like some sort of sense of humor, but it's a kind of like it's kind of mocking the reality. This is the reality. This is what it is nowadays. That like we have the defeated symbol and the living. The living capital.
It's nearly 8:30, so I think maybe if there's one more question at all. Yep. One last question.
It's more of a comment. It's really struck by what you say about feeling the governance, and maybe I'm not Palestine, but I'm not Palestine, but you know. I still have a very similar experience as doing my own research and going through a lot of archives in London. I just get the feeling that what Palestine are they talking about? It has nothing to do with Palestine. And, especially because I'm more interested in archaeology, but there's a lot of also changing the names, the biblical names, the Jewish names. And, you know, at some point it leaves you really lost, because like you explained, it's a completely different place. It has nothing to do with the Palestine that existed or that exists there. And I think it's something you should take on.
I think this is where we as Palestinians lost it, because we stopped thinking as in Palestine as a question of liberty and freedom in its ultimate meaning, and we reduced it to the state. And on a personal level, I have lots of problems with the notion of a national state. So yeah, it's definitely something that I'm really interested in. Thank you so much for your coming.
So thank you to everybody. Thank you, Mosaic Rooms, and thank you very much, Bissan.